does racism stem from? Is it the product of societal norms or personal views, or is it more subtle than that? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk with a diversity expert who says our interactions with others are shaped by deep subconscious processes. He'll share how to recognize bias and how to overcome an us versus them mentality. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk with the author of the book, Deep Diversity, Overcoming Us Versus Them. And we will welcome your questions for him, and we will welcome your own experiences. Have you personally experienced discrimination or witnessed incidents of discrimination? How did you respond to it? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Shaquille Choudhury, an educator and consultant with more than 20 years' experience in the field of diversity, equity, and inclusion. He is the author of Deep Diversity, Overcoming Us Versus Them. Next Thursday, March 3rd, he will be giving a talk at the UW-Madison Multicultural Student Center titled Deep Diversity, A Bridge Builder's Path in Racial Justice. We will put details of that up on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thank you so much for being with us. What do you mean by deep diversity?
Well, I mean two things by it. One is that in today's society, we've already had the conversation about overt forms of discrimination and racism. Generally, those are things that are accepted as negative, as bad in society. We don't really have a lot of conversations about whether they're good or bad, unlike, you know, a few decades ago. Today we're dealing more about subtle and systemic discrimination, which is difficult to talk about because it's fundamentally only becomes visible when we collect data and look at the experience of thousands and thousands of people and go, why is there a difference between the experiences of men and women? Why is there an experience of difference in the healthcare system, for example, for white people and people of color, racialized minorities? And so that's one level of the conversation. And the second level of why it's deep diversity is that what the research is really showing is that there's a lot that's going on at the unconscious level. So we really have to start understanding how our minds work. And as we actually understand that some of what we traditionally understand as racism and discrimination actually has a lot to do with unfortunately, brain function of how we react and respond to people who we perceive to be different than ourselves.
Well, for example, you are of South Asian descent, yet you say as a child you pretended to be white. Why did you do that?
Well, that's an interesting thing. The drive to belong is a core driver of human behavior. And so lots of people do all kinds of things while they're growing up to try to belong to the group, to belong to the tribe. Now, when we come from minority cultural context, there's an additional layer. And that additional layer means that sometimes, and my experience is part of that equation, is that sometimes we want to fit in, and fitting in means being white and middle class like everybody else. And so that was something that affected me, but not something that I was conscious of or could even name until I was well into my 20s. Now, to put that into context, when we take a look at the research, we know, for example, that this is a relatively common experience. For example, we know that 50% of black people have anti-black bias at the unconscious level. We know that at the unconscious level, again, that a greater number of women would prefer men as leaders and bosses than other women. We know that people with disabilities have preferences towards able-bodied people. So this puts in a context that when we come from a minority context, whether it's based on race or gender or class or sexual orientation or so on, that we absorb the messages in society about the negative things about who we are, and we tend to prefer what is in the mainstream and what is the majority. So it's not, unfortunately, uncommon.
So how did this affect your life?
Well, you know, what I did was that I basically pretended like I was white, my desire to be white. And so what I did was I basically denied my heritage, denied my culture. I didn't want to have anything to do, really, with my culture contact. In fact, I was embarrassed whenever I went out in public with my parents when they spoke, because they had a thick accent and they had imperfect grammar. I would cringe because it would feel like a big giant fluorescent sign would drop out of the ceiling that said, "Outsiders, they don't belong." And most telling was when I met other South Asian kids, other brown kids, I didn't make eye contact with them. I didn't want to have anything to do with them. So it meant that I was avoiding a lot, denying a lot, and that idea is sometimes described as self-hate. And so that's something I carried with me for a long time. And as I said, I wasn't even aware this was happening. And I didn't have the language to even understand that, and didn't even develop that language until I was in an academic context, you know, in my mid-20s, looking at issues of identity and race. And that started helping me understand what was going on.
Help us understand a little more why, for example, black people would have anti-black biases, or why women would be biased against other women.
Well, this is the thing, is that we are humans, we're tribal creatures, and what the mainstream is, what is accepted as normal, is right now in society, for example, on issues of race, whiteness is normalized. So white normalcy is everywhere. It's around us. We grow up with an understanding that white culture, white history is important. We grow up knowing all kinds of white heroes. Our social media, movies, you know, predominantly have white heroes. I mean, this is where we absorb all of these messages. And then our art, our news, all of that reinforces who is normal and who isn't. And so as a result, that affects us. We start understanding that becomes our social norm. And our social norms are the gold. I mean, that is power. When your group gets to decide what the social norms are in society, you have enormous power, because what the research shows is that in every society, there's the dominant group, and it's based on something random like race or language or religion or region or something. And minority groups exist underneath that. And in every society it's been studied, we see this similar dynamic between majority and minority. And so the more quote unquote normal identities we have, the more sort of unconscious power and unconscious privilege we have, because society's been designed for us. The majority in any society designs society, its rules, its values, who's getting funding, what's important, what's not important, more or less consciously, unconsciously, for people who are from the dominant group. And so that's why we see those norms around race, around gender, that they play out. And so we all absorb that. We've all drank from the same cultural Kool-Aid, right? And so we come to know who belongs and who doesn't belong, who's considered quote unquote an American, who's considered an outsider. And so it's just part of the socialization process from the time that we're very young to adulthood. We learn these same messages.
So tell us about the process of uncovering your own biases.
So there's so many stories. Let me share one with you. So I was at the optometrist I just needed some new eyeglasses, and I didn't have a current prescription. And so the person behind the desk said, "Well, hey, look, here's a business card of a local optometrist. You can go get your eyes checked there." And I received I picked up the business card, and on it, I read the name, and it was Abdeso Kienfar. Okay? And I hesitated. And this quote unquote foreign sounding name conjured up an image of an older man who didn't speak very good English in a dark, musty office. Now, that hesitation is the issue. In that moment, I caught myself in the act of bias. It was automatic. It was an assumption. It was a stereotype, even though this was a recommendation from the store. Now, I know very clearly that if this business card, a recommendation, had a white sounding name, Alan Goldstein or Jack Wright, I know I wouldn't have hesitated. And in that moment, I was a victim of what bias researchers would call my implicit or unconscious bias. And it happens that subtly. It's our pauses. It's our hesitations. It's our quick judgments. It's the moments where we give people the benefit of the doubt and other people who we judge more harshly. And it happens automatically and really quickly, unless we are on the lookout for it. Because here's the thing, if we don't catch ourselves in these low-cost situations, for example, in this moment, I reacted to a quote-unquote foreign-sounding name, basically a non-white-sounding name, even though my own name is Shaquille Chaudhry. It is not a white name. And if we don't catch ourselves in these low-cost situations, then in high-cost situations where there's time pressures, where the stakes are much greater, the consequences can be grave. So we know, for example, hiring managers, when we've done the research, that if you have a resume with a white-sounding name, you are 40 to 50% higher, you have a higher chance of a callback for an interview simply based on the name. Okay, those studies have been done in Canada, those studies have been done in the U.S., and black-sounding names that have Tyrone or Jamal or Letitia or Chinese-sounding names or Latino-sounding names, that all of those things have an impact, and that affects people's ability to get a job right at the start. That's affecting livelihood. We know that the similar kind of things happen in healthcare, where racial minorities are undertreated in the healthcare system compared to their white counterparts, and in all kinds of things, from transplants to cancer treatment, right down to really basic things like how well the history taking and note taking is taking place when a patient first comes in. And then when we also take a look at police shootings, you know, there's an aspect in which I believe, and I think what the research also shows is that police officers in their interaction with black and brown men may be seeing danger, threat, hostility where there is none, because they haven't been working on their unconscious bias, even though they may have all kinds of positive attitude towards fairness and equity, and may have black and brown friends. It doesn't matter if we're not if we're not catching ourselves in these low-cost situations, then at the high-cost situations, the consequences can actually be about life and death.
We are talking about our unconscious biases, and we are talking about how we can overcome the us versus them mentality with the author of Deep Diversity. And we are welcoming your questions and your own experiences. Have you tried to examine or uncover your own internal or unconscious biases? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about bias and our unconscious biases, talking with the author of Deep Diversity, Overcoming Us Versus Them, Shaquille Chaudhry, will be coming to Wisconsin next week. Next Thursday, March 3rd, he will be giving a talk at the UW-Madison Multicultural Student Center titled Deep Diversity, A Bridge Builder's Path in Racial Justice. That's next Thursday, March 3rd at 7 p.m. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question for him now or an experience you'd like to share. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org. Gary on Facebook says, viewing ourselves first as Americans rather than sorting each other out by race or gender or other personal identity class, that would be a step in the right direction. Gary seems to think we should be colorblind if we want to reduce divisiveness. Shaquille, what do you say to that?
Well, I'd say this. One is, to be colorblind is a lovely value. However, there's two things. One, it's not realistic because according to the research from Brain Science is that we register race within milliseconds. We see face first and we register race second. And this is at an unconscious level. So we're already registering that. The second thing is that when we say the idea of being colorblind, it also means that I don't actually see your difference, and our difference is actually important as well. Because, for example, as a man, I have to recognize that women have a very different path in the world than a man does, and if I just automatically assume I'm just having a human experience. Well, that means that I'm negating a whole amount of life experience for someone who's a woman. That's the same thing about issues of race. Is that we have to do both things. We have to acknowledge that yes, we're all human. In the context of the U.S., yes, everyone is American. And at the same time, we also have to recognize that our differences matter, too. So I would say we have to say yes to both of those things, because the colorblind strategy doesn't work. It actually only really works in the race context if you're white, and because racial minorities have very different experiences in healthcare, in education, in just life in general. And by taking a colorblind attitude, it means that we are basically ignoring the very real differences there. So I would say we have to say yes to both things, which is yes, we're all human, and yes, there are also differences based on our identities, and that's race and gender, sexual orientation, and so on.
Let's take a call first from Jim in Juneau. Hi, Jim.
Hey, good morning. I'm a steady listener, and I would like to engage the gentleman with debate. I'm having a very difficult time following his line of traction in order to separate us one from the other. I find out that his diversity is built upon a falsehood of removing those things which we hold dear, and that we are able to buy ourselves and the intelligence that we have received to overcome the negativity that the gentleman is attempting to present.
I don't understand,
and,
Jim. Can you tell me what
well,
you're...
we are.
I was asking, Jim, what do you mean he's telling us to... What is he telling us to remove?
Social norm. We have become now the social norm of being bigots. And that's exactly what I'm hearing from this gentleman. All human props, for instance, is the statement that he made. Well, what is a human prop? Now we have to go in and put that into another line. We are in the dominant group, which means that if I'm a white person and I engage a series of Orientals or blacks or Native Americans, that all of a sudden I'm in the minority, and oh, what am I going to do now? I am lost because this is the dominant group and I'm no longer a part of it.
I know. I'm having a hard time, Jim, following what your problem is. But anyway, Shaquille, I think he was telling our producer that he's not sure what you mean by us versus them mentality. What do you mean by us versus them?
Well, it's a really good question, and what it is that what the research reveals is that by neurological design, we are always vulnerable to seeing the world in tribes, my tribe, your tribe, and that's actually a part of how we are configured. Now, what that tribe is not predetermined. But we know, for example, that babies, up to about 3 months of age, they're responding to humans of all different backgrounds more or less the same. But we also know that by the time they hit, like, 6 to 9 months of age, that they are responding more quickly to people who share the same race as their caregiver, the same gender as their caregiver, the same language and accent group as their caregiver. So we're basically designed to constantly be defining tribe. Who is my tribe? And the challenges we face is that we haven't defined that big enough. We've been actually on a mission for at least the last 250 years of trying to expand our sense of we. So the anti-slavery movements were trying to expand our sense of we. So was women's suffrage. So was the human rights and civil rights movement. All of these were trying to expand our sense of we in terms of who we see as human and who we see as not human. And we continue that journey. And now we're at that level where society generally accepts that we are egalitarian and that everyone should have equal opportunity. That's generally what society believes in fairness today. That's what's true. Yet, even though that's our explicit belief, at the unconscious level, at the level of behavior, we see that there are trends in terms of who's being over-policed, and that's based on race. In terms of who's being over-undertreated in healthcare, also based on race. Who's earning more based on race as well as gender. So we see these trends which actually go against our beliefs that we cherish so much. And so the question is that as good people, what's going on here? Well, my belief is that people are inherently good. All of us are inherently good, regardless of our race, gender, class, or sexual orientation. And yet, there's something that's happening at the unconscious level that's resulting in different levels of treatment. And identity has always mattered. We just have been having a hard time name it because our social norms don't help us talk about race very easily, or gender, or sexual orientation. But we've been working on that for many, many decades, and we're getting better at it, but yet we've got a long, long way to go. So the us and them is something we all have to be aware of. And if we're not aware of it, then it will likely play itself out, because what is unconscious has more power. But once we can name it, well, then we can also tame it. And so the us and them, if we can become aware that we have this part inside of us that will want to see the world in tribes, that when something bad happens, we will want to look to see how tribes are involved. Right. So recently, in the shooting that just happened in Kalamazoo in Michigan, the Uber driver basically shot, killed like 6-7 people. Now he's white, and so we basically look at that and go, "Wow, you know, this person is an outlier. He's an outsider." You know, we don't automatically talk about white terrorism. We don't talk about, Christian terrorism or anything like that if he happened to be Christian. We automatically go, oh, he's an outsider. That is like antisocial behavior. He's not like us. However, when something like the San Bernardino thing happens and you've got people who are of a minority background, of a Muslim background, immediately the assumption is that that had something to do with their identity, that had something to do with their religion, with their race, and we start categorizing. And so what we should see is that those people are outsiders too. Those people have nothing to do with Islam, or don't have anything to do with they're more akin to like the KKK. Than they would be to mainstream Muslims. And yet we make that connection because right now Muslims are seen as outsiders. And so this is why the us and them, we always have to be aware that tendency is inside of us, and to go, okay, let's check ourselves, let's check our bias. And this is something that everybody has to work on, because we've all absorbed bias. And so that's where I think we're all in the same boat. And the places where it's important is that we can't be colorblind, because we also know people have different experiences. So rather than saying it's either this or that, it's actually saying, well, it's a bit of both.
We have Elizabeth on Twitter who says, I admire the bravery of your author to admit his inner bias. It should spur the rest of us to examine our own. So how do we check our bias? How do we recognize our unconscious bias?
Well, first of all, it starts by recognizing that if we are human, we all have these biases. That's what the research shows. So that's our starting point. And so we start by knowing that bias and prejudice is something that is inside all of us. The second thing is then learn to catch ourselves in the act, right, of bias. So be on the lookout for it. Notice when we have those subtle and not so subtle things that come up where we overestimate or underestimate someone based on their identity. That's really important. And once we notice that that's happening, then the third thing is to make a different choice and really look at different things we could say or do. And the last thing is compassion, that all of us are involved in this process. And it's painful to admit that we have bias and prejudice and stereotypes. So that's important. And the last thing is then to support structural change, because the dynamics of race and gender and class and sexual orientation is about power and power dynamics between majority groups and minority groups. And we should do whatever we can to support changes that constantly help expand the sense of we. So supporting Black Lives Matters and their initiative, supporting Native American rights, supporting women and helping level the playing field around issues of gender and sexual orientation and so on, and to really help help change the structures, because the structures affect our social norms. They affect our sense of we. So the two things are, we're looking at altering our brain structures and recognizing that that's at play, and altering our social structures so that we constantly expand our sense of we.
Shakil Chaudhry is an educator, a consultant with more than 20 years' experience in the field of diversity, equity, and inclusion. He is the author of Deep Diversity, Overcoming Us Versus Them, and we are talking about how we do that. We are talking about how we can recognize bias and how we can check our own unconscious biases and how we can overcome this us versus them tendency. Well, what do you think? What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Do you agree with our guests that we all have these biases that impact how we view others or how we interact with them? Have you caught yourself with some of these biases? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with a guest who will be coming to Wisconsin next week. He's coming to UW-Madison to give a talk at the Multicultural Student Center titled Deep Diversity, A Bridge Builder's Path in Racial Justice. For more details, you can visit the Multicultural Student Center website. Or you can check out the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Shakil Chaudhry, who is the author of Deep Diversity, Overcoming Us Versus Them. Welcoming your questions for him and your own experiences at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Boyd in St. Francis is next. Hello, Boyd.
Good morning, Joy, and hello to your guest. What I mentioned to your call screener was the process of ostracization, which I think is very common in our society, where, as you know, you get involved in a social group, and then you may become ostracized for whatever reason. And I think at the beginning of the show, when sometimes what are certain things that have people develop biases or racial tendencies or maybe even sexist tendencies, I think if you become ostracized from a social group, considering who may have been the perpetrator involved, all of a sudden you might form judgments and stuff like that. And I don't think I don't certainly defend it, but I think that's one of the reasons why people all of a sudden develop social biases and stuff like that.
Do you have an example, Boy, by why someone would be ostracized from a social group?
Sometimes maybe it could be because in the beginning they're friends and you know, sometimes the person who's ostracized is their own worst enemy. They might have some bad social skills that, you know, all of a sudden people tend to want to stay clear from. And sometimes it's just a simple misunderstanding.
Yeah, and therefore the person who's ostracized then would develop a bias against that social group?
I think it can happen because they felt accepted and then all of a sudden they were pushed away and they may think, oh, you know, if the social group was maybe, based on whatever, you know, I think it could happen.
Yeah, so is that a part of this, Shakil?
Sure. I think Boyd is right in the sense that ostracization happens, and ostracization can be about as the things that Boyd talked about. It can, you know, be bad experiences and so on and so forth. That's at the individual level. I'm really interested in looking at the dynamics that happen at a larger level, which is around groups. And some of that is conscious and some of that is unconscious. But we know, for example, that anti-black bias or anti-black racism, for example, is not necessarily based on people's negative experiences with black people. What the research shows is it's really based on beliefs about groups rather than actions. And so it becomes this self-perpetuating cycle and loop, is that we believe negative things about a group, and then we have what's known as confirmation bias, which is that we only remember and hold on to the things that confirm our stereotypes, that confirm our prejudice and our bias. And so that is a significant part of how groups become ostracized in society, because they have less power, and that's central to this issue. And the other thing that I want to say too is that when research shows is that our brains tend to register racial minorities and racial outgroup members more as objects and as animals rather than people. And that's the core part of dehumanizing a group of people, is that we just we start seeing them in this way. And again, this is a part of how our brain is kind of designed to see members from outside the tribe not as us. And so the ostracization that can result in less empathy, harsher judgment, over-criminalization, all these kind of things happen. And so we have to be aware that this is a part of how we ostracize entire groups. And that gets magnified when our group is the dominant group in society, because we hold socioeconomic, political power. We are able to influence policy. We are able to influence people's attitudes. We are able to determine where money goes and where money doesn't go. And that's all backed by, you know, the forces of police and military and so on. So that's what's really important to understand, is that ostracization of groups is really based on beliefs about groups, which is based on stereotypes, rather than the actual actions. And then we use the things that confirm our stereotypes or negative behavior that we might experience, and use that to judge an entire group. And that's what happens a lot.
So what does it say to you that we have a leading Republican presidential candidate who says we should build a wall to keep out rapists and murderers from Mexico, or we should ban all Muslims from entering the country because they might blow us up, or that women are irrational or mean when they have blood coming out of their eyes or wherever, and Donald Trump is garnering the majority of support from this country. What does that say?
Well, you know, first of all, I'd say that he's not garnering the majority of support from the country. He's
garnering the GOP primaries. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. And what he's there's a couple of things. One is what the research shows is that what leaders say and do matter. From the emotional intelligence research, we know that if a leader stays calm during a crisis, that settles the group members down. We know that, and then when we see the other side of this, where a leader is using anger and scapegoating minority groups, that also mobilizes people. It mobilizes a particular group of people. And in this case, it is working class white voters who also feel really marginalized from economics, from succeeding in society. So he's mobilizing that. It's very, very negative, and it's very dangerous. The politics currently, we are at a level of polarization in society that I haven't experienced in my adult life, and I don't think we have seen since about the late 60s in terms of the us and them. And at this time, leaders like Donald Trump and others that are really tapping into our innate sense of fear of the other, they're actually hitting that us and them button over and over and over again, whether they're doing that consciously or unconsciously. Leaders like Trump and other leaders like Marie Le Pen in Europe, they are completely fixating on that. And that is an extremely dangerous thing. We need to be going in the opposite direction. If in the U.S., We want to be mobilizing Americans in the biggest sense of the word, but we need to be talking about building bridges and understanding and working through our differences rather than the blame kind of approach or the attack or the scapegoating kind of approach. So it's extremely dangerous what he's doing. And what it's also tapping into, I think, is this sense that things are changing. And things are changing for the dominant group who happens to be white. And it's a really important time that we really find ways to build bridges across this, because otherwise we will have people continuing to polarize and going into camps where we are us and them, where the sense of like I'm an American changes, and it means that we've got tier one Americans and tier three Americans. And I think generally what you want to do is you want to be working towards the fact, no, that we're all Americans, but we have differences that we also need to acknowledge. And again, to say yes to both of those things as opposed to taking a side or a position. And we need to be doing the opposite of what Mr. Trump has been doing. Because otherwise we're just going to be escalating the tensions, and that's what seems to be happening. And it's a lot of political opportunism, unfortunately, in my opinion.
Interesting, when you talked about building bridges, it reminded me that just last week we had that that little debate between the Pope and Donald Trump, when the Pope said somebody who's interested in building walls rather than building bridges, he was questioning their Christianity. How do we start building these bridges?
Well, one is to start with ourselves first and foremost, as I said, and be on the lookout for where that happens within us, where we want to build those bridges, where we want to push people away. And so the steps that I outlined already there. And then the second part is really to choose compassion and openness. Because, you know, if we want to tackle polarization, if we want to tackle extremism, which is happening in society, belonging is the antidote to extremism. Belonging is like the kryptonite, in fact, to extremism. And so when people don't feel like they belong, we react, and we can react really negatively, whether we come from a majority group or whether we come from a minority group. And so... doing whatever we can to increase that sense of we, and that is, that's always through relationship building. So how do we build relationships with one another? Do I talk to my neighbor who is a little bit different than I am? What am I doing in my workplace? And so starting those conversations is really important. And then on a bigger structural level, supporting any process that tackles the polarization and the extremism and really works towards bridging, towards having conversations, towards creating more positive change. Because when it's us and them, everybody loses. Nobody wins in this. And so I guess for me, it goes right from the micro right to the structural and the macro.
Carl in Madison is with us now. Hello, Carl.
Yeah, what a powerful conversation. The example of the gentleman in Kalamazoo who clearly had some mental illness or challenge, and is in recent news with this shooting, compared to he's either a mentally ill or someone might offensively call him a nut, but the people in San Bernardino, well, those are Muslims, so. This sense that we categorize so quickly, I worked with student teachers in public schools for a number of years and watched the relationship between children of color be fundamentally damaged by the inability of well-meaning white teachers to see this invisible fishbowl, this thing that we've been immersed in since birth that causes us to cast an immediate lens over those in front of us so that we can't see them clearly. We see them through stereotype that we're not even aware of, and rather than unconsciousness, it's sort of a disconsciousness. It's this sense that we're willfully ignoring those aspects of our culture that that limit our children's potential. So in a positive note, if we can get past this, if we can think through, all right, if there's a connection between how I view people who through my sense of difference, man, we could fundamentally change what it means to be successful in America, what it means to be seen as an American citizen, as a citizen of the earth. So thank you very much for your work on this and for the program today.
Thank you, Carl. I'm Shaquille.
You're welcome, Carl. And, you know, by training, I'm a teacher, and I work with in the context of public education in the Canadian context for about 10 years or so. And I think what you're talking about is so important because, of course, teachers and school systems are critical. And we know that racial minorities are there's a history of, again, similar to the criminal justice system, that that students who have learning disabilities and are racial minorities are definitely, again, over-policed in the context of education. We know that they are punished harsher, there's more suspensions, all of that is there. Also, there's streaming in which racial minorities especially have been pushed into less academic streams. And some of that is because they haven't been understood well, their work hasn't been acknowledged, and this is the function of stereotypes. We always have to recognize that our stereotypes and our bias and our prejudice literally act as filters. It will affect what we see and what we don't see, what we hear and what we don't hear, and that that can create incredible dissonance for minority students, whether it's based on race or sexual orientation or social class and so on. One of the conversations I remember the most is I was working with a judge I was having these conversations with a judge who was in the context of the Netherlands, and her and I were talking about unconscious bias a lot, and we were always, she didn't quite understand where I was coming from and why the overcriminalization within their own system might be happening. And then the penny dropped for her, and in a conversation she said to me, you know, I realized something, that when I am, and she was white, and she said, when I'm looking into the eyes of a white child that is in the criminal justice system, I see something that's similar. I see something that reminds me of somebody I know. But when I look into the eyes of a racial minority child, I don't see anything. I don't feel anything. And that was her turning point. That was when she realized, aha, there's a difference here. And that is unfortunately extremely normal. It's how we choose our friends. It's why we love our families. The only problem is that when we are working in education or in employment or whatever, it's a terrible way of increasing fairness in society. It's a terrible way of increasing democracy, because if we just choose those people that are most like us, that we like the most, that we resonate with the most, we're going to leave out swaths of people. And that's fundamentally how racism and discrimination and sexism and heterosexism and homophobia and transphobia, that's how all of that plays out. It's about the different people who are, we consider to be outsiders. And we always have to be suspicious when we put people into that camp, because that's an internal mechanism that we have to be on the lookout for.
We look forward to hearing your talk when you come to UW-Madison next week. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Joy. I really appreciate being on the show.
Shaquille Chaudhry is the author of Deep Diversity, Overcoming Us Versus Them. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.